From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Who among us doesn't have at least one urgent garden question? Ken Drews and I have been asking ours to each other for decades, and today we're back to answer some more of yours, as we do each month on the show. But first, this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
You all know Ken Drews, my longtime friend and fellow garden writer, author of The New Shade Garden and Natural Companions in Making More Plants, among other great books. Are you ready for some listener questions, Ken?
Decades?
Decades. Yeah, well, when did you write the Natural Shade Garden and the Natural Garden? Hello.
Well, let's move on from that.
Okay, goodbye. So, you know, actually, before we even do listener questions, I have a question for you because I was looking something up in Making More Plants, your sort of propagation book, the other day, and it got me wondering, are you doing any sort of propagation-related mad science over there in your garden these days? Because you haven't told me about any of you. You normally have some, like, wacky projects going on.
No, thank you. Moving along.
Okay.
I
Boy,
always have
I'm really
going
striking
on.
Out with you today.
Are you are you talking about, like, making my own strain or something?
Yeah. I mean, I thought that, you know, you must be, because you've told me sometimes, but then I haven't had any follow-up. So tell me about that.
Oh, wacky is right. Let's see. Well, you know, people talk about strains of plants and heirlooms and things like that. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about an heirloom, which is a strain, they don't say strains, it's usually a version of a plant that's propagated or grown in isolation so that it retains the characteristics. And if you don't grow it in isolation, then it ends up either reverting to the original species or it gets mixed up with some other strain and then you lose it. And that's how people retain the characteristics of an heirloom tomato, for example.
Yeah, like instead of allowing genetic drift to happen by neglect, by not caring for it and keeping it, as I say, true to type, to what it's supposed to be like, it can drift away from that. Yeah, so nobody's minding the store and the thing drifts. But you're talking about what then?
Well, I guess the simplest version of it would be the double poppies that I have. And I have these orange poppies and little ones, and they're single ones, and occasionally I get a double. And for about 3 years or so, I was pulling out all the single ones, and now all of mine are double.
So this is selection. You're kind
right.
of selecting.
So, and mm-hmm. it's a strain, or I could say it's an heirloom, except it's not that old. But I have another plant in the garden, which is a kind of verbascum. And, mullein. So yeah. It's a kind of mullein, but unlike the roadside mullein that has hairy gray leaves mm-hmm. and one flower spike, mine has multiple flower spikes, and it blooms for about 6 weeks.
Wow.
Which is a long time for a biennial.
How tall is this thing?
It's about 5 foot tall.
Wow.
And it has about between 4 and 6 arms, and each of the arms, like a candelabra, mm-hmm. has more arms coming off it. So it's really just covered with flowers. And I know where this came from, because I originally had a species, which was Verbascum undulatum, which has a wavy leaf. And I was also growing at the same time a hybrid called Harkness hybrid from England, and it croaked, actually. I had it for about 1 year. But what came up in the garden were some really interesting Verbascum. And I started to save those, and anything that didn't look like them, I would pull out. And they have a wavy leaf, mm-hmm. and it's green. It's not very hairy. And that became the strain. And now every year, luckily, I get between 2 and 12 plants of this Verbascum strain. I've shared it with some people, and it seems to be kind of true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my Verbascum strain.
So you have it's an annual poppy, the orange one with the little double flowers, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. Huh.
I'm trying to remember what the species name is.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll put it in your.
It's like the, is it like the California poppy ish? Like
no. I keep wanting to say alpine, but that's not right either.
Okay. Well, we'll just go look it up afterwards before we do the transcript. But so you're kind of selecting, you're noticing things that are a little different, and you're saying, right. "Ooh, I kind of like that." And then you're guiding it by, as you said, like you're roguing out the single orange poppies and only letting the doubles set seed for next year.
Right. And pretty much now, after about 4 or 5 years, they're all double.
And do you have you ever done this with woody plants in any way? I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but have you ever noticed something on a woody plant that was, do you know what I mean? Or is it just with
I know what you mean. Not really, but I have with herbaceous perennials, and actually a perennial that you love, which is Geranium macrorhizum,
uh-huh.
That ground cover. I saw one that had white variegation.
Oh.
Just the kind of little lines of white. Now, that could be a disease or it could be something else. So
virus.
What you want to find out. Yeah. So I have propagated that, and it also retains the white. So it's actually a variegated white on green geranium macrorhizum. And now I have it in three places, and that seems to be, we'd say, stable. So it's probably not just an aberration of funny soil or something
going
on. And, you know, you see something like that in the garden, you think, I'm going to be a millionaire. This is it. Everyone's going to want this plant.
The big
all
bucks
give
in
me
horticulture.
Royalties.
Woohoo!
And frankly, that doesn't really happen,
no.
or very rarely.
You're reminding me, the Broken Arrow, it was either Andy Brand, who no longer works there but did for many years, or Adam
Wheeler.
Yeah, Adam Wheeler came to the garden, as they do do my plant sales at open days. And one of them pointed out, walking along the path, that some of my European ginger, shiny-leafed, kind of kidney-shaped leaf ground cover, Acerum europaeum, that one plant had kind of mottled leaves. And it could have been a virus. It could have been, what, as you said, something in the soil. Or it could have been stable. And he said, oh, let's mark that, you know, kind of like let's put a stake there and sort of say to ourselves, let's look at that next year, kind of. So I guess they're always on the lookout because they love unusual plants. and they're always looking, you know, to introduce something new or whatever. So they're looking for, as you say, stable ornamental features that are different. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, sometimes that happens, and sometimes that actually ends up being something valuable, although very rarely.
Right.
And
right.
So the things that people find are not usually accidental. They're kind of intentional, the ones that really make money. But you look in your own garden. I'm talking to the listeners.
Yeah.
And you might find something. It's not, may not the thing that, you know, gives you the new house in the Hamptons, but it might be something that you want to perpetuate and discover if it is stable and if you maybe develop your own strain.
Yeah, kind of fun. All right, so now on to the promised reader/listener question. Sorry, readers, listeners, I didn't mean to delay, but I meant to ask you that, Ken, the last time we spoke. I have a question from Linda on dodder. And she says, I know, she says, the native and parasitic plant dodder has shown up on my landscape. I've been working all summer to get rid of it. And she had yet to read about anyone else that has experienced it. So she welcomes any information. Now, have you experienced dodder? First, we should probably explain, kind of tell us what it looks like.
Well, it's related to morning glories.
Yeah.
And it is orange and it's stringy and it sprouts from a seed, and then it has about 2 days to find a host.
Yeah.
Just by being a vine. And if it doesn't find a host within a couple of days, it's used up all the nutrition that's in the seed, and it croaks. But it usually does find a host, and then it climbs up the host, and it sticks suckers into the host and lives off it as a parasite.
Yeah, so it's a parasitic thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those little, like, hold fasts that then suck the life out of the host plant, or I think they're Haustoria, H-A-U-S-T-O-R-I-A. I'm visualizing the word. I remember the word. Really, like, these specialized structures that let it do that. And it doesn't, dodder doesn't have any real roots or real leaves of its own. It does have flowers, like you said, and it does make seeds. And it, what's really cool is that there's like 200 kinds around the world, like different species.
Oh, really?
They're all in the same genus, I guess. It's Cuscuta, C-U-S-C-U-T-A. You know, and as you said, it's in the Convolvulaceae, the morning glory family. But yeah, and so we have some native species in the U.S. in different areas, but now there's a Japanese invasive species. So as if it weren't bad enough to have native daughters strangling Yikes. And sucking the life out of certain host plants, some agricultural areas, especially like in California and some other places, are being besieged by a Japanese outbreak, species as well. Crazy. So
what do you do about it?
So it looks like this yellow or orangey string, like that's twining,
right?
Okay.
Right.
Let's talk about it in the garden setting because, you know, sure. In the agricultural setting, it's a whole nother nightmare. But what have you done? You said you've had it.
Well, and I do. Usually, almost every year, I see a little tiny bit of it, and I get it right away. Some years, after the flood, actually, it was everywhere. But now I see a little bit, and I go to the host,
yeah.
And I take every bit of the daughter that I possibly can, and I put it in usually a paper bag that goes in the trash,
right?
Not on the compost. And it's very brittle, so it breaks while you're trying to collect it into pieces, and each of those pieces, I'm told, can start growing. So you got to get all of it. It seems to like the native wild impatience, which is something I can sacrifice. So if I have to, I'll take out that whole plant
right.
with
and,
the daughter
yeah.
and just get rid of it.
And the different species of daughter are host specific. You know, they have different preferred hosts. So, you know, again, there are ones that are like agricultural pests of like alfalfa or carrots or onions or potatoes. There's one that's into that likes cranberries as its host. You know, all kinds of different things and even ones that seek particular weeds, things we consider weed species, and parasitize that. So, you know, they're specific. They have specific relationships with other species of plants. Very interesting. And the seeds that it creates can last, I read somewhere, 60 years in the soil. So the thing most important of all is not to let it go to flower, these
yes,
tiny little
I was gonna
flowers,
say.
Right? And you can track those around from place to place in the garden or a farm field, you know, on your shoes, on the tires of, you know, a wheelbarrow or a tractor or whatever. So, you know, it's this not spreading it inadvertently, this hidden thing. Some people say you even should take off the, rather than try to just pull the daughter off the host plant, remove the parts of the plant that have been entwined and hooked into, so to speak, because you may be leaving inadvertently some behind.
Right, right.
And then, of course, you know, a lot of people use chemicals and whatever. In a garden setting, we're not going to do that. I had it 1 year, and I never had it again. And I did what you said. So I think it's vigilance, you know, and over and over and over and over, not letting it flower, et cetera.
It's lucky. Yeah. We're lucky that it's bright orange, you know.
Right.
Because you can see it.
Right. And I'll
imagine
yeah.
if it was green. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. With the transcript, there's some pretty interesting, you know, research about it and so forth. Up to the minute, I mean, they're even like trying to sequence the genome of it at the moment. So there's kind of interesting stuff. I mean, in that it's a parasite and so forth. And I'll give some good links with the transcript. But Phlomis, Anne had a question about Phlomis, a mint relative, a perennial that's a mint relative. She says she listens every week from out in Olympia, Washington, finally writing in with a question of her own. She planted 4 Phlomis russelliana, young healthy plants, last fall. Only 2 of the 4 bloomed this spring, and she says, what's up with that? Why would the same plant, you know, they look the same in the same cultural conditions, act differently? And then she notes that the conditions that she's offering are not ideal for the plant. It's a clay or a kind of clayey soil that drains less well than the plant might want in its sort of native habitat. So what do you think?
I could ask her like 50 questions.
Or.
or. I love Phlomis, and it's beautiful. And I wish I could grow it. And the problem for me is it's just too humid here, because that's a plant that really wants great air circulation. It wants the Mediterranean. It wants to be dry and have great drainage. And she's challenging it maybe by not giving it great drainage. But I think Olympia, Washington's kind of has dry summers, which is what it would like. But hearing you describe all that, my first guess is that two of them just aren't mature enough.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, you know, we see plants in the nursery and it looks like, you know, there might be a flat of 36 of something and they all look, quote, identical. But, you know, maybe the roots beneath the soil surface in those pots, maybe half of them are a little more or less developed, right? Or the division that they came from was a little more or less, don't you think?
Yes, so get in touch with us next year.
Yeah, I want to know. I think they're going to do okay. I don't think the clay soil is ideal, probably.
No, but if they're alive and
they're
pretty much together in the same place, and it depends on what was the winter like, blah, blah, blah. You know, if they had a dry winter, they would like that, really. Yeah. They don't want to have wet feet in the winter.
But I do think, you know, the products, these are not widgets, as we always say about plants. You know, they're not widgets. Mm. They're not uniform. And so we have to expect some, just like people or animals, will settle in more or less slowly or quickly, right? Give them a chance, yeah. We had a question from a Dutch gardener. He says he's from Holland, and he says his English is not that good, but it sounded pretty good to me. He grows Euchomus, doesn't say the species, but they're flowering really well. They're in the ground, in the garden. He wants to collect the seed to create his own bulbs eventually, and his question is, what stage of the flower development, what would the flower look like when the seeds are ready to collect?
I can't believe you're asking me this.
Why?
Because I'm such a sucker. You were asking me about experiments, and now that you're saying that, I'm remembering. Euchomus, which is the pineapple lily, has these beautiful flowers right at this time of year. And it's August for me. And the flower spikes come up, and then they have these star flowers on this fleshy, succulent stem. And then sometimes, very often, fruits form. And the fruits are about 5/8 of an inch long and kind of around, even though they're not round. They're like little pointy things. And inside those fruits are shiny black seeds. And the black seeds call to me from across the garden, collect us, propagate us. So I cut some of those stems and I carefully put them under the sun porch so they wouldn't disappear, which sometimes seeds do, especially because these fruits will turn dry like pods.
Right.
But the seeds are ripe before they turn papery, and I didn't want them to fall out. So I put them in a place I thought they were okay. And I collected some, and I thought I'm going to try to sow them right away. And they actually came up. And then that was last year, and I'm thinking these are going to take 7 years to bloom. I'm really sure they will. But I happened to notice, and we had a very cold winter, I happened to notice something growing in the gravel under the place where I had them.
Really?
And, you know, everything likes to grow in gravel.
I know.
Which is perfect.
I know.
And all the whole area there is crushed rock. And I thought, what are these? And I realized they're Euchomus seedlings. And they went through our very cold winter, although it's close to the house, so they probably liked having a chilling period, and I think if I sowed them again, I might give them a chilling period.
Mm-hmm.
But I sowed them and they came up under lights, and we'll see what happens. Go ahead.
So the stage of the ripeness so it's just before it gets so papery that they might disperse. Is that when saying
they start
the
kind of a color? It depends on which one. On the white ones, they're kind of green pods, and on the red ones, they're kind of reddish colored, and they start to get pale.
Okay.
They lose their color.
Okay.
And I cut them before they got dry.
Okay.
Because I thought they would get papery,
and
then
the
seeds would
fall
out.
That's the trick with saving seed a lot of times is sometimes it disperses itself if you don't get it a little early.
Right.
Right?
And it was a little early, exactly.
Right.
But I should have put it in a tray instead of on the table because those little round rolling seeds seem to have fallen to the gravel, some of them. And I guess I don't know what should I do? Dig them up or let them grow there?
I don't know. That's interesting. I've never had them self-sow. Huh.
Try gravel.
You know,
we were -10 here,
yeah,
and Euchomus aren't that hardy.
No, it's funny. I think they're like a zone 7 or maybe 6B-ish thing.
Right, but yeah. I think the seeds are hardier, which is the case with a lot of things like
Interesting. Interesting. You know, I said in the introduction that you and I have been asking each other questions for a long time. You took exception with the length of time, I said. But the other day you asked me a question, and I thought, well, maybe other people might want to know, but you're going to have to ask me again. Do you remember what you asked me about?
Are you talking about your Nicotiana?
Yeah. Yeah. Just as an example of the kind of stuff that you and I, because we're always emailing back and forth
that,
saying like, do you know this? Do you know that? I mean, it's a true thing. I wasn't making that up in the introduction when I said that. You and I have been asking each other urgent garden questions for decades. I know you
we could do hours on that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess it was probably the last time I was at your place, which again, around this time of the year, and you had a huge, I'd call it a meadow, next to the house of Nicotiana, and most of them look like Mutabilis,
yes,
which is the Nicotiana that the flowers change color, and it's pretty tall, and I never was there at night, and I never actually sampled whether it was fragrant. So I wondered if Nicotiana mutabilis, the beautiful color-changing Nicotiana, which I've never grown actually, whether it smelled.
Yeah, this is my favorite Nicotiana. And when you say meadow, it's kind of this, yeah, it's a lot of plants all together in a group. It's not like actually out in a field somewhere. It's adjacent to the house, and the reason being completely selfish. Hummingbirds, and the Nicotiana's for me, the flowering tobaccos for me, flower in late summer, so from late July, mid to late July, through the hard frost. And that's when the one species of hummingbird we have in our area, you know, the ruby-throated, is coming through in large numbers, you know, moving the populations that were farther north, and they love to stop at the garden. They love to stop anywhere where they can find nectar, yeah? And so I put these big masses, of Nicotiana near to the windows so I can sit there and just be delighted by these crazy groups of hummingbirds, you know, kind of visiting me. So that's what the, quote, meadow is for. Mm-hmm. And so I have a few of these plantings, again, self-sown sort of plantings, naturalized, near where I can see them. So Mutabilis is a really tall one. I mean, it's probably as tall almost as I am, and very statuesque, like a big candelabra-y kind of thing. And the flowers start out, I believe, dark pink and fade to white. No, wait. They start out white, and you asked me, I think. That's where I got my head on backwards. They start white. And I was just looking at one today, actually. And then they gradually age. Each flower, each ages to pale pink and then even rose. So sometimes you have like three or four shades of from white to rose, you know, on one big plant. I don't think there's any fragrance. You know, what's the big white one called?
Alada.
Yeah. There are a number of Nicotianas, and the one that has the really tubular flowers.
Sylvestris.
Yeah, Sylvestris. Those, I believe, have a scent, but this does not seem to have a scent. And I've even been outside in the evening, and because I'm into moths also, and I have never noted any fragrance whatsoever. So that said, we've run out of time.
You're going to send me some seed?
Yeah, I should try. I'll have to put – now, that's one that will disperse the seed whenever it damn well pleases, you know, on a moment's notice. So I'll probably have to put a bag over some of those. You know what I mean? Like put a little paper bag with a twisty tie or something so that the seed falls into a bag for you. But yes.
Thank you.
Yes, yes. All right. Well, thank you, Ken, for some help with the urgent garden questions. And I'm sure I'll be emailing you something that I need to know any minute now. So be on the lookout.
Yes, Papaver rupifragum. That's what you need to know.
Oh, okay.
Spanish poppy.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Good.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, I hope. So don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at facebook.com/awaytogarden, on Instagram by the same name, or on awaytogarden.com. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.